This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Nehemiah. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in the book of Nehemiah chapter 1 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
Nehemiah chapter 1. Danny Murtaugh was the manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates when I was a young man following baseball. And I like what Danny once said. I like to have on my team that fella who hits a home run every at bat, strikes out every batter, and throws perfectly to each base from the outfield. Any manager would want a guy like that. The only problem is to get him to put down his cup of beer and come down out of the stands and do those things. In other words, it's easier to criticize than it is to mobilize, to talk about it than to take action. And this is especially true in the church. The church today has far more pundits than we have players. We need men and women of action, men and women who will step up and serve. Nehemiah wasn't just a talker. Oh my, he was a doer. Nehemiah got off the sidelines and into the game. God called him to do a great work, and he obeyed. Nehemiah led the third wave of Jewish patriots from their exile in Babylon back to Judah. You remember from our study in the book of Ezra, Zerubbabel rebuilt the temple. Ezra rebuilt the people. But it was Nehemiah who rebuilt the walls around Jerusalem. In verse 11, Nehemiah identifies himself, verse 11 of chapter 1, as the king's cupbearer. You know, in the United States, if you don't like the president, the most you have to live with him is 8 years. And if you help spike the ballot box, you can get rid of him in 4. But in a monarchy, if you had issues with the king, you had to live with him for a lifetime. And this was often more than the critics could bear. In an Oriental court, it was too easy to bribe an official or to sneak in undercover and poison the king's punch. Thus, the cupbearer was the king's first line of defense. If the wine was laced with deadly hemlock, he would be the first to know about it. Needless to say, the cupbearer, Nehemiah, had to be a trusted man and an honest man. And thankfully, Nehemiah's services were never needed. Chapter 1 begins with a person, a place, and a date. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, he came to pass in the month of Chislev, which on our calendar would be from mid-November through mid-December. This was in the 20th year. This was the 20th year of the reign of one of Persia's most famous emperors, Artaxerxes Longimanus. The exact year was 444 BC. Nehemiah mentions his location at the time. I was in Shushan, the citadel. Shushan was a tropical, warm weather getaway about 250 miles east of Babylon near the mouth of the Persian Gulf in what is today Iran. At the time of the Persian Empire, Susa or Shushan served as the winter residence for the royal family. Now, according to Nehemiah, it was while he was in Shushan that Hanana, one of the brethren, came with men from Judah and asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. Now, it had been 90 years since Zerubbabel had led the first wave of Jews back from Babylon to their homeland of Jerusalem. Nehemiah is asking for a progress report. How are things going? How's the work progressing? And they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. And this was all the information that Nehemiah needed. For if there were no walls, nothing else would have been done. You see, a city's walls afforded it protection and allowed that city to prosper. Without walls, the city would stay in rubble. The city would lie in ruins. Nehemiah loved his God, his nation, and his city. At stake was the future of his people, not to mention the glory of his God. Work needed to be done. These walls needed to be rebuilt. This news upset Nehemiah. It shook him up. No pun intended. It hit him like a ton of bricks. Nehemiah tells us in verse 4, "So it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven." Now, hey, Nehemiah is a nice guy with a nice job in a nice place, working for a nice man, drawing a nice salary, until suddenly God rocks his world. Get the picture. Our man Nehemiah, he has it made. He is a Hebrew living in the king's palace. He sips the king's Chardonnay. He eats the king's food. He wipes his mouth on the king's napkin. Nehemiah occupies a prestigious position. He is on the Persian payroll. He is a powerful man, and he enjoys a luxurious lifestyle. I picture Nehemiah footloose and fancy free, not a care in the world. This cupbearer's cup is full of blessing. Until one day, God spikes his cup of blessing with a burden. God adds a burden to Nehemiah's blessing. Suddenly, Nehemiah not only bears the king's cup, but he bears the Lord's burden. He goes from contented to restless, from glad-hearted to grieving. We're told here he mourned for many days. And I believe this is what God wants to do in the life of every single believer. He has a specific plan for your life. He has a task he wants you to accomplish. He has a burden for you to bear. Like Nehemiah, God has blessed you and me in a million zillion ways, but now he wants to add a specific burden to his blessing. He wants to send you on a mission for God. I've heard it put, life's heaviest burden is having nothing to carry. A burden from God allows you to participate in kingdom construction, to have an impact for eternity. And that is the opportunity that God gives to Nehemiah. But notice what Nehemiah does when he receives this God-given burden. He immediately bathes it in prayer, verse 5. "And I said, I pray, Lord God of heaven." Now, as I said earlier, Nehemiah is a man of action. He is a can-do guy. He would have made a good Marine. But he understands that waiting on God always precedes working for God. When God places a call on your life, it may be to teach Sunday school, or maybe to gather up a group of middle school girls and help disciple them in the Lord, or perhaps grab some teenage boys and teach them what you know, or maybe take a new Christian under your wing, whatever that burden might be. When God places a call on your life, the first thing to do is to put a call into God. Rather than rush out and act immediately, Nehemiah puts his burden on his heart's rotisserie and then just sort of turns it over and over in prayer. He waited until his heart was right, until the time was right. Until then, he just sat tight and he prayed. And here's how he prays. "O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments." He reminds himself that God is great and gracious, awesome and merciful. He continues in verse 6, "Please let your ear be attentive and your eyes open that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night, for the children of Israel, your servants. And confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Both my father's house and I have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses." Notice what Nehemiah says in verse 6. To me, this is astounding. He says, "I have sinned." Now, he could have blamed the Jews that God judged. They would have never gone to Babylon had his forefathers been wicked and done evil in the land. The city was destroyed because of their rebellion. He could have blamed the Jews who had already been in the land for the last 90 years. Why hasn't more progress been made? He could have blamed Ezra the priest. You remember, he left for Jerusalem 13 years earlier. What's he been doing all this time? Instead, Nehemiah admits the situation is his fault. I have sinned. Instead of critiquing others, Nehemiah looks inward. If he had returned earlier, perhaps he could have helped with the work. Instead, he had chosen to stay behind and live in luxury in Shushan. Nehemiah knows a vital truth about leadership. If you want to be part of the solution, you first need to admit your part in the problem. It's been said no snowflake in an avalanche ever feels responsible. Most people go to great efforts to duck responsibility, but not the leader. A leader refuses to play the blame game. Jerusalem's walls might not have been in shambles if Nehemiah had returned earlier. He says, I have sinned. And then in verse 8, remember, I pray, the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast out to the farthest part of the heavens, yet I will gather them from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. God had told Moses that he would scatter a disobedient people. And scatter them he did, back to Babylon. But he also promised that he would bring back a repentant people. And if the Jews returned to God, he would work again in Israel. Nehemiah finishes his prayer. Now these are your servants and your people whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. God had kept his promise to scatter them, and now God is going to keep his promise to gather them again. Verse 11. O Lord, I pray, please let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name. And let your servant prosper this day, I pray, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. As the chapter closes, notice those phrases, this day and this man. Nehemiah gets more specific in his prayer. He's now praying for an opportunity. You know, it's true, praying to God and waiting on God always precede working for God. But you do get to a point, once you've prayed, that it's time to take a step of faith. You always get to that point when it's time to act. You've prayed enough. Now it's time to do something. And that time is nearing for Nehemiah. He closes chapter 1 with the reminder, for I was the king's cupbearer. And it's his close proximity to the king that sets up chapter 2. Once, though, there was a cardinal that landed on the windowsill next to the yellow canary in the cage. This red cardinal, he looked at the canary and he asked him, he said, what's the purpose of your life? The canary answered, my purpose in life is to eat seed. The cardinal said, what for? He said, so I can be strong. What for? So I can sing. Well, why do you sing? So I can get more seed. The cardinal thought for a minute and he shook his head in disbelief. He said, now let me get this straight. You eat seed to be strong, so you can sing, so you can get more seed to eat. This doesn't make sense. The canary says, well, that's my life. Finally, the cardinal said to the canary, you know, I believe there's more to you than that. And if you'll follow me, I'll help you find it. But first, you must leave your cage. And that is exactly what God is saying to you and me. There is more to life than going to work, to make money, to buy food, to become strong so that we can go to work again the next day. Guys, follow Jesus and he will lead you to a kingdom purpose. He will add to your cup of blessing a burden, something that you can do for him. But to follow Jesus, you must be willing to leave your cage. In chapter 2, Nehemiah leaves his cage, verse 1. And it came to pass in the month of Nisan, which would have been mid-March to mid-April on our calendar, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. Now remember, when Nehemiah heard the news of Jerusalem, chapter 1, verse 1 told us that it was in the month, the Hebrew month of Chislev, which was mid-November to mid-December. So evidently, 4 months have elapsed After hearing of the trouble in Jerusalem and sensing a God-given burden to act, Nehemiah still waits 120 days before he steps out. Again, he knows that God's work needs to be done in God's time. You remember years earlier, God had revealed the exact day that the Messiah would present himself to Israel, to Daniel. You remember that prophecy? Daniel chapter 9, the prophecy of the 70 weeks. Daniel said that predicted 69 sets of 7 years. And ultimately, this prophecy would point to the very day that Jesus would ride his donkey down the Mount of Olives into the city of Jerusalem, April the 6th, 32 AD. But this amazing prophecy had a launch date. It started, and I quote, with the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem, the street shall be built again, and the wall. In other words, Daniel's prophecy was tied to Nehemiah's request to build the walls. Nehemiah may not have realized it, but the 4 months that he had waited on God were actually God was using them to fulfill this prophecy. If Nehemiah had forced the issue, he would have wrecked Daniel's prophecy. God often has reasons that we know nothing about. The reason he calls on us to wait, the reason his time is not right, sometimes he doesn't tell us. This is why Isaiah 28 verse 16 describes true faith. Whoever believes will not act hastily. Well, when the day finally arrives, wine was before the king, and I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now, I had never been sad in his presence before. Therefore, the king said to me, "Why is your face sad? Since you are not sick, this is nothing but sorrow of heart." So I became dreadfully afraid. See, part of the cupbearer's job was to cheer the king. You know, you tell a funny story, tell one of Pastor Sandy's jokes, you know, make the king laugh. That was part of his job. And that meant a gloomy cupbearer, oh my, he was in danger. He might have his head on the chopping block. Nehemiah's sadness proves that he can't harbor a God-given burden for very long without it affecting your disposition and your demeanor. You can't. When God lays something on your heart, you can wait, you can pray, but eventually you got to do something and it'll drive you nuts. Nehemiah is visibly disturbed. He can't hide his sorrow any longer. And the king notices that something is bugging his cupbearer. And Nehemiah answers him, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste and its gates are burned with fire?" Boy, he just spills the beans. Nehemiah realized the time has come to approach the king about what God has laid on his heart. Verse 4 says, "Then the king said to me, 'What do you request?' And so I prayed to the God of heaven." I like what one Bible commentator writes. He says, before answering the king, it was essential for Nehemiah to speak briefly to someone else. Nehemiah shoots up a real short, succinct, spontaneous kind of prayer, a cry for help, a spiritual SOS, you might call it. One commentator said, calls it Nehemiah's arrow prayer. He just kind of shot an arrow up into the sky. I like to call it a flare prayer. That's what it was. Nehemiah just suddenly shoots this flare up into the sky. "So I prayed to the God of heaven." It's one of those prayers we launch at times. "God, help me." And it's a prayer, by the way, that God answers. I hope you realize your prayers don't have to be long to be effective. God answers that little SOS prayer, that little "help me, God" kind of prayer. You remember Jesus said of the Pharisees, "They think that they will be heard for their many words. Do not be like them." In other words, it's not the length of your prayer that counts, but the strength of your prayer that counts. I do think it's important, though, to recall that Nehemiah now has been fasting and praying for 4 months. This flare prayer comes after a concentrated season of determined prayer. But the prayer that makes it to heaven is not necessarily the one that consists of lots of words. Rather, it's the one made up of a lot of heart. I like the saying, short prayers will make it to heaven if the person who prays them doesn't live too far away. Recently, I read of a true story that came out of Los Angeles. A woman was upstairs in her bedroom when she heard someone breaking into the house. She crawled under her bed with her phone and she called 911. But for some reason, the emergency system was having a problem. It gave her a menu of options. Realizing that this was going to take more than a minute or two, her mind raced for other ways to reach the police. She grabbed the phone book next to her bed and she called the nearest Winchell's Donut Shop. And she asked the employee if there were police officers present. The employee said, "Of course, we've got several right here eating donuts." An officer was put on the line and the frightened woman told her of her problem. He arrived at the house in time to catch the thief. Hey, the good thing about God is you never have to worry about him being out eating donuts. He is always on the line. Hey, even better than 911, just dial G-O-D, all right? Nehemiah says to the king in verse 5, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it." Nehemiah might not have been expecting it, but here's the opportunity he's been looking for. And he has the presence of mind to jump on it. When you see an opportunity, act, jump on it. A funny story is told of Bear Bryant when he coached at Kentucky years ago. The Wildcats were playing Tennessee when a runner fumbled the ball close to the bench. In a mad scramble, someone over on the bench kicked over a box of 8 more footballs. They all tumbled out onto the field. A free-for-all ensued. As it turns out, Tennessee recovered 5 footballs and Kentucky recovered 4 footballs. The referee, not knowing which was the original football, gave possession to Tennessee. They had 5 to Kentucky's 4. Here's the moral of the story. When the ball bounces your way, jump on it. Make sure you grab it. When an opportunity presents itself, seize it. That's what Nehemiah did. Verse 6, "Then the king said to me," and the queen was also sitting beside him, "How long will your journey be, and when will you return?" And why does Nehemiah mention the fact that the queen was sitting beside the king? We're not really sure, are we? Unless perhaps for some reason the queen was particularly fond of Nehemiah. Maybe she had befriended him in some way. Maybe he was one of her favorites. Perhaps she was nudging her husband, you know, trying to, you know, whispering in his ear, "Go ahead and help Nehemiah with this venture." Which would prove, gentlemen, that God can even speak to you through your wife's nudge. Amazing. "And so it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time." Nehemiah is on a roll. He senses that God's hand is on this exchange between he and the king. If the king is willing to give him permission, why wouldn't the king be willing to give me some supplies? Hey, always remember, real faith is not afraid to ask, and that's what Nehemiah does in verse 7. "Furthermore, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river Euphrates, that they must permit me to pass through till I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he must give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, which pertains to the temple, for the city wall, and for the house that I will occupy." Hey, now, this is a bold move on Nehemiah's part. Nehemiah asked the king not just for permission to return, but for the supplies he's going to need to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. He wants the king to finance the project. How's that for a bold request?
You've been listening to Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. Pastor Sandy's teachings come out of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Today, Pastor Sandy is working his way through the book of Nehemiah, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. Sometimes it's easy to assume that if you're not a missionary in a foreign country, you're not being used by God. Now, insert Nehemiah's character into the story, and you realize that God uses ordinary people in the regular world for his purposes. Nehemiah was not a priest. He was a man who served a foreign king, but God positioned him in such a way to be used powerfully for the rebuilding of the wall in Jerusalem. There were all kinds of political and relational upheaval going on in Jerusalem, but Nehemiah and some others were strategically planted there during that time to bring about spiritual revival. Don't you want to be a part of something like that? Just remember that you don't have to be overseas to do the work of God. He can use you in your workplace, in your home, and in your neighborhood. If you'd like to hear more messages like this one, head over to sandyadams.org. While you're there, check out Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain under the About tab. That's all for today, but we look forward to continuing this study in the book of Nehemiah. Come back for more on Sandy Adams Radio.